Hello, everybody. Dr. Doug here for another podcast with Dr. Howard Baum here in Nashville. Hello, Howard.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good, good. It's good to have you back, and glad we get to talk about another topic that I think is of interest. Obviously, you're an expert at diabetes as an endocrinology professor. Now, what is your status?
I've got a very long title.
Yeah, what's
so
your permit?
My
what's
title is Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Endocrinology and Program Leader of the Clinical Trial Center of diabetes obesity here. So I've got a lot of fancy titles that don't amount to a hill of beans.
Does that fit on a card?
I write it very tiny.
Very good. Very fine point. All right. Well, look, I wanted to get from you some specific and interesting comments from your perspective on diabetes and what I'm going to call your diabetes wisdom. You know, my little booklet that I just showed you had a little section on a diabetes wisdom. You haven't read it, so you can't comment if it's wisdom or not. But clearly, you are quite the expert in diabetes. And so, what, you know, if there were a few pointers or sort of clinical pearls, as we might say, that you've learned over the years about diabetes, from the patient's perspective, or maybe from a clinician's perspective, I'd like to hear those because I think it would be really fascinating to know them for patients and for myself as well.
One of the things that patients and doctors don't appreciate is that, unfortunately, diabetes is a progressive disease. And that is to say that over time, the blood sugar will tend to get worse. So typically in diabetes, you start with a person who has some sort of genetic tendency that their own insulin doesn't work very well. So insulin is what we make with the pancreas to move the glucose, the sugar, from the blood vessels into the muscles where it works as fuel. And so in individuals who are predisposed to diabetes, their insulin doesn't work well. We don't know what is behind that problem. We call it insulin resistance. So to overcome insulin resistance, you make more insulin and you can keep the sugars down and do just fine. But over time, in individuals with diabetes, the ability to make that extra insulin starts to decline. So the insulin output declines to the point that the glucose is no longer able to be delivered effectively into the muscles, and that's when the diagnosis of diabetes is made because the blood sugar is elevated. So you do some things to correct that. You get the person to introduce less carbohydrate into their system, fewer calories into their system, so there is less to get put away. So you don't need as much insulin. You try to get the person to lose a little weight. Even 3 to 5% of weight loss can help, and it helps by making the insulin work better. It reduces that insulin resistance problem, as does physical activity. So let's say you introduce lifestyle modification, and maybe you introduce a medicine that also helps the insulin do its job better, like metformin. And you say, great, we've got the blood sugar under control. But 4 years in, you're finding the blood sugar creeping up. And so the patient thinks, what am I doing wrong? And the doctor thinks, what is the patient doing wrong? Well, the patient isn't doing anything wrong. It's just that their insulin output continues to decline. And so if you look at large groups of people with diabetes, about anywhere from 8 to 12 years into the disease, at least half of the people are needing insulin treatment to supplement their declining insulin production. So I think often insulin is seen as a punishment. It's seen as a patient failure, and therefore we have to use insulin because you've failed. But in fact, this is the natural history of the disease. And so I make it clear to people that this will be a part of their treatment plan if they live long enough, so that I don't have to use the insulin as a threat. I don't have to have an argument about the necessity of insulin. It's just part of the national history of disease that insulin output will decline, and ultimately insulin treatment will be required if the patient lives long enough.
Okay. So
that's the biggest lesson that I have to transmit to patients on a daily basis.
Okay. And I think that's good, because I think you do make an important point about how we tend to look at ourselves. I mean, I think as a doctor, I always am critical of myself, wondering what more can I do? And of course, patients who are, especially ones who are being really good about their treatment, I think really feel bad when they get to that point where they're like, what am I doing wrong? Like you said, why is this not working as it has over the past years? And they need to recognize this is what happens.
It's expected. I think that sometimes patients who are particularly compulsive about their health view their blood sugar as a grade on their behavior, like a school grade. And if it's not doing well, that is a reprimand. It is a grade on their behavior. And sometimes, obviously, that's true when people go off the rails and eat inappropriately and are constantly sedentary. But it isn't always a reflection of what the people are doing. So I think it's important to try to depersonalize some of that and get rid of some of the finger waggling at the patient and try to just treat the disease like you would treat other progressive illnesses.
Okay. Okay, very good. What other things? I mean, obviously, this is a fairly broad question. I mean, other things that strike you maybe in the realm of particular treatments, things related to medications. Obviously, there are a variety of pills for patients with type 2 diabetes. And I'm talking more about that than the young juvenile onset diabetic patient. What other things do you think that are just little, you know, sort of smart things you've learned that you like to transmit to patients about their treatments or what's good, what's to be avoided, things like that?
I think that we have an environment where individuals, whether it's legal practices, whether it's people trying to promote their own supplements or websites, are very quick to jump on side effects of medications and dangers of medications. And it's appropriate to think about what are the risks, what are the side effects of particular medications. But I think you have to understand what are the chances of these negative things happening before you reject a category of drugs. So, for example, the drug Actos or pioglitazone, if you look on the internet, you will read all about its problems in causing bladder cancer. Now, we could get into some pros and cons of Actos that might make it a good or a bad drug, but with particular reference to the concern about bladder cancer, it's really statistically a very small problem. So if you take, I tried to find data, how common is bladder cancer? And in one study in the United Kingdom, it looked like that a middle-aged man, say 55-year-old man, I'm now calling that middle-aged since I'm around that age, one in 600 men of this age get bladder cancer. And I estimated that if you look at what do the chances become if you take Actos, then maybe it's one in 400. And to me, that's a pretty small number of people that are getting bladder cancer, even if this risk is real. And yet, that becomes often the number one reason that people shy away from Actos. Now, as I say, there are a lot of pros and cons of Actos that might give me pause about prescribing it. But it's interesting that I end up having these long conversations about bladder cancer when that's really not the main issue that should be on the table. So I think being very careful when you're selecting medicines not to overstate the risks of the medicine and to remember that there are also benefits of the medicine that may outweigh it.
Well, you know, toward that end, I think I'm not sure if the reason for that is that we tend to minimize to a degree or want to minimize the negatives of the diabetic condition itself. In other words, we'd like to think, well, you know, people can do well with diabetes for many, many years, and they really can, particularly if they're more conscientious about their treatment, both in their own, the things they do and in the medications they use to control their sugar. But, you know, I think when people hear that idea that the side effect profile has a certain negative, they don't put it in the context of what the negatives are of the disease itself. And I think that's partly because we don't want to say to them, well, you know, this is a very dangerous disease, because in many ways it's one that they can mitigate. We don't want them to think like there's a sword of Damocles over their head.
So,
do you think that's true?
Well, so I think that speaks to a general principle, which is you have to think of the risk of the medicine and you have to think of the risk of not taking the medicine.
Right.
So if you have pneumonia, and you say there's a risk that if I take penicillin, I could have an allergic reaction. But there's also the risk if you don't take the penicillin that you could die of pneumonia.
Right.
So you have to think of what negative thing will happen by my rejecting the medicine. So I think that all medicines are going to have side effects. And very few people, you know, if you look a year after diagnosis of diabetes, more than half the people will have failed simply using lifestyle modification as a treatment. So you're going to get into medication treatment for the majority of patients. So there are going to be side effects to everything you use. So you're correct that you don't want to overstate the risk of the disease, but you're going to have to use medicines and you're going to have to accept some side effects. So being as thoughtful as possible at what are the side effects and how is a particular side effect going to affect a particular patient. So again, using the example of Actos, one of the concerns I have about it is that it causes fluid retention. And in individuals with vulnerable hearts, that fluid retention could translate to congestive heart failure. But if I were treating a 28-year-old track athlete with diabetes, my concern about contributing to heart failure is going to be much less than if I am treating a 70-year-old who has a lot of heart risk factors and may not have even had a heart evaluation. That person, I might trigger heart failure. So I think you have to individualize the side effect risk and be very thoughtful and think, what tools do I have? If you reject all of the medicines, or you say, I don't want to take Actos because of bladder cancer, I don't want to take Byetta because of pancreatitis, I don't want to take glimepiride because this class of drugs has been associated with heart attacks or with low blood sugar, eventually you've rejected all the treatments and you're left with just dealing with the diabetes without any treatment. So I think that if you just start rejecting every treatment based on a side effect, you're kind of left holding an empty bag.
Very good. And that makes sense, given the fact that you've described how fundamentally people are going to have some form of treatment. They're not going to be able to do this through lifestyle modification. Now, talking about sort of diabetes in general, I always think of what I call the diabetes industry. And a few of the aspects are just checking sugars and what your goals are, you know, what you set for people. As a general principle, obviously, there's always individual things that one needs to try and figure. But the question is, talk to us about, you know, how often should people be checking their sugars? Let's say if they're under fairly good control, fairly stable results generally, what do you say about that? Like, some people love to check their sugars, other people hate it, but what's a guidepost in your mind?
One thing that we have in common is that when we are recommending a treatment for a patient or a technique for a patient, a procedure for a patient, we would prefer it if we have some sort of scientific backing for what we're telling people rather than just basing these recommendations on some opinion or experience in a few patients. So it turns out that this problem of looking at blood sugar monitoring has been tested on many occasions. Individuals who are not on insulin and therefore are not adjusting their treatment on a day-to-day or meal-to-meal basis could have been tested in a fashion that half the people are assigned to check their blood sugars regularly and the other half of the people are told not to check their blood sugars. And then you look at their hemoglobin A1C blood sugar numbers 3 months into the thing. There's no difference between the two groups. So the theory of having a person on an oral medicine or a non-insulin treatment to check their blood sugar is that this will inspire them because they will see the high numbers. Oh, I need to eat better. I need to exercise more to make that number go down. Turns out when you give that technique to large groups of people, they actually don't do any better. I guess it's just human behavior. You have the best intention. You see the high number. It's a very hard number to move. And so people don't change their behavior. So individuals who say, you know what, maybe most people don't benefit from this, but I find it reassuring or helpful to know what my once-a-day blood sugar is in the context of taking oral medicine. It comforts me when I realize that I'm stable. It alerts me if I'm getting off the track. I'm fine with it. Check once a day, no problem. If a person says, I really don't like checking my blood sugar. I find it disruptive to my day. I find it sort of unpleasant. It reminds me in a negative way of my diabetes on a daily basis. I said, I do not compel you to check because I cannot show that this is helpful. Insulin treatment is a whole different deal. That's not going to be the majority of patients early on. With insulin treatment, you have to check at least periodically to make sure that you don't need to adjust the insulin dose up or down. But I don't necessarily insist that all people check blood sugar.
Very good. All right. I think that's good news to a lot of patients who'd like not to, obviously. But we don't want to just cater to the people who, you know, live in fear or just have some sort of negative concern here. But, you know,
sure.
You want to be reasonable.
When you're on insulin and you need to check your blood sugar, certainly there are new techniques that are a little less uncomfortable and we can make that work. The other thing you mentioned is what are treatment targets? And we use the A1C number, the amount of sugar or the amount of your hemoglobin on your red blood cells that has sugar stuck to it as an indicator of where your blood sugar stands. And in general, if we can get to a level under 7%, an average blood sugar of under 155 in younger, healthy patients, that's where we'd like to get. If low blood sugars intervene or medication complexity becomes overwhelming, we might relax that standard a bit. Individuals who are prone to low blood sugar, older people over 65, we might say the standard, the American Diabetes Association says that can be relaxed to 7.5. Somebody who's nearing the end of life or who has very limited resources or very limited skill in managing all their medicines, you might say, I just want to avoid a blood sugar that's going to cause me a symptom today. I don't want to have a lot of blood sugars in the high 200s. And then the A1C standard could be 8.5. So a 90-year-old person with multiple medical problems, a hemoglobin A1C of 8.5 is going to avoid high blood sugars with dehydration, probably good enough for that population.
All right. Anything else you want to add? I think those are really just outstanding guidelines, honestly, that just put a perspective to things, because I think there's a lot of drive out there to, you know, sort of criticize patients and really make them feel like they're not achieving some expected goal that may or may not be valid for them to realize. And it's nice for them to be told, you know, you don't have to feel compelled to test your sugars as often if you're not, like you say, adjusting insulin with regular basis. You don't have to feel like you must achieve super tight control of your diabetes, although it's a nice goal to set for oneself. One shouldn't be ultra critical of themselves. Anything else that you can think of that you want to add?
Well, I think that the main thing is that the challenge for doctors and the reason why a lot of doctors don't like taking care of diabetes is that it is a patient-managed disease. The patient is managing their diet. The patient is managing exercise. The patient is checking blood sugars potentially and adjusting treatment. There's almost no other medicine, no other condition where the patient self-adjusts their medicine on a daily basis. And I think that it makes it hard. And so it's a hard chore, and patients do their best and doctors do their best, and you work together to hope for a good outcome.
Very good, Howard. Thanks. This has been great. Thanks.
My pleasure.